I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nickturn on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/be-here-now for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn on May 28th.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I literally had a weightless, dizzy sort of sensation in my body. And it was just, you know, trying to wrap my 9-year-old brain around this concept of infinity. It opened my mind to the incredible vastness of the universe, of life beyond death, of infinity.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling, and somebody that many of you probably know, because he's a filmmaker and has done some incredible documentaries in particular, and just want to welcome you, Frederick Marx, to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So Frederick, as I mentioned, is very well known, particularly one film that many of you may know, who are a little bit in the middle between young and old, something like that. It was in the 90s. And
that's very generous. I would say old folks.
Yeah. I'm trying to be generous because I'm an old folks.
Well, the film's 30 years old.
It is? Holy shit. Hoop Dreams, everybody. That's the film. And I want to hear a little bit about it because I'm a huge basketball fan. And let's just talk about formative years, because I always talk to people that I've never met before on podcasts and find out what is the thing that was, a turning point to realize you are not just this ego, mind, desire, system, repel, attract, all of it.
You know, for me, arguably the greatest teacher in my life has been death. And the first big lesson around death arrived on my doorstep when I was 9 years old, and my father died suddenly of a heart attack. And he was seemingly there forever in my life when I went to bed, and then gone forever the next day. And I never had a chance to say goodbye or any kind of closure whatsoever. So a number of things happened. One, on the way to his funeral, my uncle, he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Well, Freddie, you're the man of the house now." And so that began for me an inquiry into how to become that man. How do I become the man I want to be? And of course, I wanted to be, you know, a supporter to my mother, my older sister, and my younger brother. And I was nine. And of course, nobody stuck around to show me how to do that. So that avenue sort of led to all of my inquiry into what is mature masculinity, mentorship, rites of passage, initiation, all of those things. And then the other avenue led me to Dharma. And it really led me into inquiry around the meaning of life and death. And I struggled so mightily, you know, as 9 years old, to try to wrap my head around death. And it was my first introduction to the concept of infinity. And I used to lie in my bed at night and I would think about, dad's dead, and death, and he's gone forever. And I'd say forever, 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 over and over in my head. And then I'd stop. And then I go, but wait, it goes on. And I go forever, forever, until I began. I literally had a weightless, dizzy sort of sensation in my body. And it was just, you know, trying to wrap my nine-year-old brain around this concept of infinity. So as early
you recall
as I
that,
could,
huh? And, you huh? recall that the inner feeling of that?
Like, oh, absolutely.
Infinity.
Yeah, the vastness, big. Right? It scared the shit out of me, right? And and it also underscored, of course, the fact, the emotional fact of my father's not returning. But beyond that, it opened my mind to the incredible vastness of the universe, of life beyond death, of infinity. So anyway, as soon as I could as an adolescent, then I started trying to understand this. And I picked up the book by Alan Watts off my parents' shelf. Yeah. And read that when I was 14 or 15. I'm like, well, this makes a lot of sense. This is pretty cool. Mm. And then when Be Here Now came out, a couple years later, I was, 17, 18. I thought, wow, this makes a hell of a lot of sense. So anyway, but it wasn't until 20 years later, I was in my mid to late 30s, that I finally was introduced to a practice of Dharma. And that became instrumental for the rest of my life.
What was that?
Well, actually, practice. It was in New York City. And my first introduction to practice was through the SGI, the Soka Gakkai International, which is a Japanese form of chanting Buddhism. Typically, it's the Heart Sutra and the Lotus Sutra that get chanted. Most people know it, if they know it at all, through the singular phrase, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo.
Yeah, and Tina Turner, that's who I remember was doing
exactly.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, she's been a lifelong practitioner. And also Herbie Hancock as well.
Right.
So anyway, it's a wonderful practice. And there are many things I loved about it. But I actually got sort of stuck with the practice about 5-6 years into it, interestingly enough, around the time that Hoop Dreams came out. And then I shifted into Vipassana practice for about 4 or 5 years, and then first got introduced to sitting meditation practice. And then around the year 2000-2001, I met my Zen teacher, Junpo Dennis Kelly. And so for the last 22 years or so, I've largely been practicing Rinzai Zen.
Wow, that's quite a journey.
Yeah, well, I always say I never met a branch of Dharma that I don't love because I love them all.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful. The teachings are so rich and so inspiring for me.
Yeah, that's the beauty of us living in a human body at this time in human history, basically. We have every possible offering in front of us on a silver platter. We really do. I mean, that is the beauty of digital communication. The downside, we all know that too, but...
Yeah. Well, and now it's most essential that we practice, right? Because when you look at the world around us, you know, we've got collapse with a capital C that is already happening. And so what interests me about collapse is how do we balance our understanding and holding of all of these horrible things that are happening to the planet and war and, you know, not just environmental destruction, but literally collapse of economic and political and social systems, and still hold some equanimity and some sense of balance and even humor and joy in the face of all of this awfulness.
Yeah.
So that's what really interests me of late.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's what you just described is what Ram Dass represents, what he created with this foundation, the podcast network, and all of it is exactly that. You just defined it all. And it's a definition that is a real responsibility for those of us that can focus enough to care to do something outside of what's good for me. And of course, that is the central theme behind Ram Dass's, what he conveyed over the last decades and still does through all these things that we do. So, Frederick, tell me a little bit. So, was Hoop Dreams was not the first picture you got involved with, right?
Oh, no. Excuse me. I'd already been making films for about 15 years at that point. But, you know, you were absolutely right. I mean, by far is my most successful film. And, you know, to this day, if I'm known at all, typically it's through that film. But did you want me to talk about how I got onto that? Or?
Yeah. That,
well, I
in
love
particular.
Basketball. It's pretty simple.
Oh, yeah. Okay, here we are. We've
I
got
love
something
basketball.
Big time in common.
Yeah. You know, when I was a kid, I was born in Philadelphia. Back then, the Warriors were the Philadelphia team. This was before they moved out to the San Francisco Bay Area. And Wilt Chamberlain was my lifetime hero. I mean, I wanted to be the next Wilt Chamberlain. So that was my dream, you know. I wanted NBA stardom, right? So I only stopped about 7 inches too short
and
a million skills too short. But otherwise, I could have been the next Wilt. So anyway, my glory days ended when I was in high school. But the, you know, the love for the game continues to this day. And I still watch the Warriors. I'm going to watch them tonight. You know, I love this basketball team. I love the kind of basketball that they play.
Not to mention what they represent as humans, both the coach, the owners, you know, the leaders of the team, Steph Curry. I mean, how outspoken they are for righteous thinking.
Exactly. And it's interesting because there's a big distinction between them in that way, between the other team that I so loved and was privileged enough to watch all of their games during the Michael Jordan years in Chicago. I watched the Bulls for 10 years as they won all those championships. And only on that team, there was Craig Hodges, who really stood out and said, you know, we need to use our fame for good. We need to do something with this platform that we have. And he kept trying to get in Jordan's ear and get him to do something good, and he never succeeded. But anyway, so that's another reason why I love the Warriors. But back to Hoop Dreams, you know, it was in graduate school. I met my foundational partner, Steve James, and we were we both had the dream when we were kids. He did as well. But we wanted to look at the difference between middle class white kids having the dream and what is it like for, you know, lower income inner city black folks. So anyway, that's how the project really got started. And it was originally going to be a half hour piece for PBS that blew up and became this 3 hour piece, actually became two films. We actually finished a half hour piece. We called it Higher Goals, made it a separate film, and that went on to have its own success and glory, but mostly in the TV and in the educational arenas.
Yeah, yeah. And it's about, for those of you who don't know, and you can still watch it, a wonderful movie, two young black kids from inner city Chicago, and you know, you filmed all that stuff of them in their school, and it was the environmental atmosphere was so profoundly present in this film. I think it went a long way, obviously, the story, but just that part of it gave people a sense of connecting with outside of this white middle class privileged bullshit. So from that to me is a very strong perspective that this film represented.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, when we were just finishing the film, we would do test screenings and we would show it to some lay people who didn't necessarily care about basketball at all, but basically had a social conscience and were interested in race issues and class issues and related things. And they would say, this is great, but it's too much basketball. You know, it's like, you got to cut out the basketball stuff. And then we'd show it to basketball fans and they go, this is great, but you got to, all that family stuff, the poverty, the joblessness, the school, the hell with that, right? When I heard that, equal complaints from both sides, I thought, we found it. We've got the balance that we want. And in fact, it proved to be successful.
Mm. Yeah, phenomenal. Now, the movie that I just saw and that you had given me the link to and so on, that is absolutely incredible. Now, it's called Journey from Zanskar, which is a small village in what, Bhutan?
Well, no. It's in northwest India. It's an ancient kingdom that is adjacent to Ladakh.
Oh, Ladakh. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
But you got to tell this story. I mean, I want to know, how in the world did you do what you do? I mean, so yeah, just here, give the premise. I'd rather you do that.
Well, I'll tell you this too. You know, the original idea for the film was something entirely different. So the original idea was the Dalai Lama's youngest brother, Tenzin Choigyal, known as TC, is the reincarnated owner of the seven sacred monasteries in Zanskar. And so he was scheduled for a rare visit to those monasteries. And this was the summer of, was it 2004? My God, it seems so long ago. Mm. And so anyway, so I got a crew together. We got all this equipment. We land in Delhi and the monks meet us and they go, TC canceled the trip. So like, okay, great. So what am I going to do? So we fly to Leh, which is the capital of Ladakh. And I literally don't know what we're going to film. So I started looking around and I actually found a kind of a secondary story that I started filming that I thought was kind of interesting. It's Helena Norberg Hodge's work that she's doing in Leh, which I don't know. You want me to go into it? It's an interesting sort of side story.
But sure.
Well, she does beautiful work with the indigenous Tibetan people of this region. And you know, historically, these people, they're part of the Tibetan plateau. So they're all Tibetans. You know, they speak Tibetan. They practice Tibetan Buddhism. But it was a historical anomaly that when the British left India in 48 and drew the modern borders of the state of India, that suddenly they found themselves in what used to be a foreign country in India. So at any rate, that isolated them tremendously. But so I forget the name of I think it was called the Farm Program. So basically, what Helena set up was this program for young people from around the world. They would come to Leh and they would get placed in with families who were traditional farmers in the region and learn not only organic farming and sustainable farming, but they would also learn the communitarian values of these beautiful Tibetan people. And in addition to that, she also would do sort of reverse tourism and would take some of the Tibetan farmers to the United States.
Really? Wow.
To show them, hey, by the way, all of that crap that you're being sold about how glorious the West is and how rich everybody is, take a look. There's a lot of homeless people. There's a lot of suffering everywhere, and there's not much community. So anyway, that's part of what I started to film until Geshe, our chief monk, on the way to Zanskar, and in those days, it was at least a 24-hour car ride. Well, in fact, it still is, but it'll soon change. And that's only for 4 or 5 months.
Oh, that's right. They're putting a big thing from Manali through Ladakh, right? A tunnel, the whole nine yards, I heard about.
Bridges, all of it. Yeah, they've been building it for over 20 years.
Yeah, nothing. That's nothing.
And it's nothing, right. So anyway, we drove, and he goes, well, you know, I've been thinking I'm going to take some kids from Zanskar out to lower India, to Manali, so that they can learn Tibetan culture, language, and history, because our own region doesn't teach it. There's a private school that does, but 75% of the local kids can't afford it. And so our own language, culture, and history is dying in Zanskar. Mm. So so I said, well, what are you planning to do? And he goes, well, we typically walk over this mountain pass called Shinku Pass. It's about 17,500 feet. And then we walk to Manali. Okay, well, that sounds interesting. I guess I'll go. So that became the film. So we filmed these two monks as they visited all of the village families and decided which kids they're going to take with them. Ended up taking 12 kids. The oldest was 12, another was 11. Most of them were 4 and 5 years old, leaving their families possibly forever just to go to these schools and have these opportunities that they otherwise would not have in Zanskar.
You know, Frederick, popped in my mind, the scenes when they're leaving, these young children and the mothers, some of the mothers, and the way in which they absolutely wanted this opportunity to happen for their children. And yet it was devastating. It was like the beauty of them being able to sort of live on, Ram Dass used to say this a lot, and I always quote it because it's important. You can live on more than one plane of consciousness at the same time. So they lived with the grief and the hope in the same moment, and it was conveyed beautifully.
Yeah, well, it's heartbreaking, right? That any parent should have to make a decision like that, you know, to try to do something to maximize their child's future potential, but to do it away from home, away from the family.
Yeah, well, then it's not like you're going to go from, you know, Hoboken to Newark or something. It's not happening.
It's not happening. You can't catch a train and be back at night. It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there were a lot of Western mothers who saw this film and said to me, oh, I could never make that choice. Well, okay, fine. Lucky you. You know, reflect on the privilege that you have that you're not forced, in a sense, into making choices like that. Well, these parents are. And so they made the best choice they could, and it was heartbreaking, and it was the right choice.
And then ensued this trip that you actually filmed. I mean, I cannot believe it. I was, everybody listening, you got to see this film, and it'll all be in the show notes, links to it and all. But Frederick and his crew, like, got vantage points beyond where they were traveling through these, I mean, just incredibly difficult terrain, to say the least, 17,000 feet, never mind. And then you got, and you see the difficulties and the potential dangers. Some, there was people who died, right? I think
not from our party.
No, but
fortunately, thank goodness.
Yeah,
yeah. But there were
bearers. There
well, I don't want to give away too much of the story.
Yeah, right.
But okay. We had challenges crossing the pass, and then the next day. There was a party of two people that did cross the pass, and one of them died on the way crossing. And this was late October, so we were already pushing Jesus it. Christ. I mean, the snow was already 3 feet deep. And I'll tell you one story that's not in the film. You know, I thought Geshe was going to die that day, and he that is in the film. But later that day, when we got back to our camp, I told him that. And he goes, yeah, I thought I was too. But I thought you were going to die first, Frederick. and we both laughed because it was really true. I actually was further back on the trail than Geshe himself was, and he was struggling mightily. I was thinking, oh my God, this is my last day on the planet. Well, at least I'm doing something I love.
Really? Oh my. Okay, we won't give any more away. There's all sorts of different scenes that come to mind in this film. But just, you dove into that. I mean, that took a bunch of courage, shall we say. I mean, you didn't know what you were going to end up doing.
No, hardly. Not at all. No.
I mean, did you even have the right gear and all that for that kind of... Of course, these kids, you could see they did not have the right gear. And
yeah,
the monks.
Yeah, compared to them, we were extremely fortunate. I mean, we had, you know, triple thick, long underwear and gloves and things. And, you know, in the film, there is one of the fathers of the kids goes snowblind because he didn't even have sunglasses, for God's sake. Yeah, we were in an extremely privileged position relative to them. But it's not to say that we were any more good humored than they were, because they were laughing and rollicking and having a great old time. I mean, there were a few kids that were really struggling, and mostly that you see it in the film. There's one kid who doesn't want to ride the horses.
Yeah, he's afraid of horses.
You know, and so is scared of the horses, and so is crying a lot. But most of the kids were having a grand old time. So anyway, yeah, it's, you know, there a lot of people. I mean, I had a reviewer from a Canadian newspaper go, well, this film is a scam. It's just full of shit, because everybody knows they could have whipped out their satellite phones and called in a helicopter and gotten rescued, and nothing would have been an issue at all. And I'm thinking, I wish, if only. Yeah. We did not have satellite phone. We did not even have a budget to have that kind of access, much less call in helicopters and stuff. It was like, no. It was, this film was done on an absolute shoestring, and I had a crew for most of the trek. It was myself and one other guy, one other person. You know, we could have used at least three more crew members, but I didn't have the budget for them. We couldn't afford them.
It's you and one other person?
Me and one other
sound person. And video?
And then I lost him at one point for reasons I won't go into, because it'll give away too much. He had to fly back to the States for another film, and so I had to do all of the shooting in Leh and Manali myself. I was a one-man crew.
Holy Jesus. Oh, my. Well, it's fantastic, everybody. I mean, I am very attuned to Tibetan Buddhism, and it's very meaningful for me. And at the same time, I don't think you need to know anything about it whatsoever to really get connected. I mean, just speak to, for instance, Frederick, speak to the perspective, because you said, you know, no matter that we had a lot more gear, we couldn't say that they, you know, they had probably more humor, good humor, no matter what. Speak to that perspective, the difference between us and the them. It's a different kind of us and them, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's such a deep a layer of acceptance among the Tibetan people up in Zanskar and Ladakh that just goes back generations, right? And it's not something that we tend to experience here in the West. You know, we're all living under this illusion, this mind-numbing, mind-fucking illusion that somehow, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins, right? You know, that consumerism is somehow a pathway to deep and abiding success and happiness. And of course it's not, but you know, we're not inculcated with these cultural traditions, which are so rich and so meaningful. So that's one difference. And, you know, I'll point to a scene, too, where, you know, before we tried to cross the pass, we show the two monks doing a puja in their tent. And Geshe makes it very clear. He says, you know, we're not praying for the success of our mission and of getting over the pass tomorrow. We're praying for the well-being of all beings. That's who we're praying for. And I just got a chill down the back of my spine that, because it underscores that it's not about me first. It's about me together. It's about us. It's about all of us together. And they model that so beautifully in this film. So that inspires me a lot.
They model that so beautifully as a culture. I mean, it's just extraordinary. Really. And just small, not small, so small things, but just being able to hang out with discomfort the way we cannot is extraordinary. And with good cheer.
With good cheer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And eating the tsampa, you know, that was another difference. You know, basically they would pull the tsampa, which is a ground barley flour, and basically make stone soup every night. You know, that was their dinner. It's like, okay, well, you've got a vegetable, great, we'll chop something up. Oh, you've got some spices, cool, we'll throw it in. They'd make a communal soup, and then that's what everybody had for dinner. You know, we, on the other hand, you know, Geshe made sure that he hired two guys to basically serve as cooks for myself and my cameraman, and also the two monks, so that we would not have to worry about preparing food in the morning and in the evening. And we, you know, we got luxuries. You know, we had eggs and we had peanut butter and bread and stuff. So, and then in the daytime, we're eating power bars. That's how kind of how we got through.
It's so incredible.
Well, and I should probably also mention to your listeners, the Dalai Lama is in the film, and he basically is sort of bookends the story in a way. But it's all started with him, because he understands how precious Zanskar is as this unaffected small region of the Tibetan Plateau that has not been taken over by the Chinese, right? It's on the Indian side of the border. And so the culture is still intact. And he made it very clear to these monks that it's like, you need to do everything in your power to keep the culture intact, to keep the language and the historical traditions intact.
Yeah.
So that's what sort of got them going on this whole mission. And then also Richard Gere was kind enough to step in and to volunteer to narrate the film for us.
Yeah.
So he did a beautiful job with that.
Yeah. What's happened since then? Have you kept in touch?
Yeah, you know, it's 18 years. So the kids are all grown up now. You know, most of them have stayed in Lower India. They've been back to Zanskar maybe twice, in my understanding, to see families. The first time they came back, again, underscoring the remoteness, you know, they were bused in, but there was all kind of trouble on the pass and blah, blah, blah. They had a half an hour in Padum, the capital of Zanskar, with their families to visit before they had to get back on the bus and go back. So that was the first visit. But since then, I think some might have made multiple trips, but I know of one group trip that happened. And then we're able to stay longer because they went in the midst of summer. Mm. But, you know, most of them have gotten educations and are becoming doctors, lawyers, engineers, teachers, a lot of teachers, and moving on with their lives and careers.
Mm. Just wonder if they've feel any of the same commitment that the Dalai Lama, of course, His Holiness, expressed about keeping intact the traditions. I wonder.
Well, that was the hope, right? And that was something that I discussed many times with the monks is, you know, with their hope was that once educated, once, you know, introduced to the ways of the outside world, they would come back to Zanskar and become the teachers and the educators and the professionals that the community needs to help sustain it. But knowing Tibetan language, culture, and history alongside Western.
Yeah.
And some have, I believe, but I don't know for sure.
Mm. Right. And yeah, amazing movie, everybody. And it'll all be linked up in the show notes. So, you know, I want to, so you're a very much a Renaissance man of my heart, actually, Frederick, because you put some of your creative juice into writing. And I did see something that I kind of want to talk about. Not just that, in service as well. I know that you've been involved with young men in terms of related to initiation processes. I just want to read this thing. Okay. And this is another thing we will link up, which is, Rights to a Good Life, right? Is the name of the book.
Yes. And the subtitle is Everyday Rituals of Healing and Transformation.
Right. So everybody, let me just read Frederick's, just for a few paragraphs from his preface, which again, completely connects with what Love, Serve, Remember represents, Ram Dass and so on. We live in a culture that could be characterized by the absence of the sacred. Our education, our business, our healthcare, our transportation, our media and entertainment most often lack a sense of connection to the vast, tender, powerful, mysterious, sacred nature of life. And even when we have a personal brush with the sacred, when someone dies near us, when we take special time in the high mountains or connect with the moving work of art or are present for the birth of a new child, the compelling sense of sacred mystery can quickly fade as we resume our quotidian chores. The absence is exacerbated by our divisive political discord, our racial and economic divisions and injustice, by our unattended trauma, both individual and collective. Yet, underneath, when we get quiet and honest, there is in almost everyone a longing for deeper connection to ourself, to the earth, to the community around us, to life. This deep connection to the sacred and to your own unique gifts and courageous place in the world is what Rights to a Good Life and Rites of Passage remind you is possible. And
well, it's very nice of you to quote the book, but I didn't write it.
What?
That's Jack Kornfield. He wrote the preface.
I didn't read down to the bottom. Are you kidding? Jack wrote the preface? Okay. You know, you didn't have to say anything. Isn't that great?
I'm not going to pass off Jack's beautiful writing as my own.
It's funny because I just came back from Maui, where we did retreats with Ram Dass every year there forever, and we're still continuing them. And Jack has been at most of this winter retreat, and his wife Trudy. And it's funny because what he said here, and I'm so sorry, everybody, please excuse me, and I'm sorry, Frederick. I don't care, though. It doesn't matter. It came out through this thing, that you offered. And the reality is it is all of us as one moving along the path together, really. But Jack did he did one session where he connected with the people attending the retreat, a few hundred, 350, 400 people, in which he exemplified exactly what he said in this thing. He brought the sacred into, he opened it up so that the sacred connected with the trauma. I don't know, there's got to be a better way to say that. He created a space by engaging with individuals around not just trauma, but around life stuff. You know, Jack is really incredible around, it's okay to be human, you know. I was quoting him at one other session. He was sitting in the room. I said, and that's Jack Kornfield. So we're doing the same here. And but the reality of what this preface opens up is really what I wanted to hear more from you about. And your initiative to really open this door, especially to young people, that there is a way to bring the sacred into one's life. And to me, and a lot of what Ram Dass represents is service, intention, and perspective, and that can really make a big change. What do you think?
Well, of course, yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, there's a chapter in the book called "Making Every Moment Sacred," and I talk about how, in a sense, I've been on a mission to understand how to do that ever since I was a kid, and arguably from the moment when my father died. And so I look at that, and I ask myself. And I talk about what it is I've begun to understand around how we need to reinvigorate our daily lives with the practice of self-created ritual in order to make that happen. And it's not hard. And we don't have to follow long prescriptions in order to do that. We can do it very simply. And a lot of it, yes, has to do with how we initiate and mentor adolescence, because for me, and again, this goes back to what I told you about not having a father, I desperately needed to be initiated as a teen into mature masculinity. I had no idea how to get there. And none of my my father's brother didn't stick around to mentor me and show me. None of my father's colleagues at the University of Illinois stuck around to show me, who I loved dearly. And so I had to sort of invent it for myself, at least to a certain point in my life. And so I've always been looking for these ways to bring the sacred back into the everyday and to make our lives, you know, that much more meaningful. And it's not that hard. So the book is about the why and the how of doing that, basically.
How have you approached, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old kids related to even presenting the reality of what the sacred is. In practice, how have you approached it?
Well, it's interesting because in my experience, most adolescents already have a sense of that. And they already have a sense of how they're being denied access to it. And they know that they're living in a world of illusion. And because their bullshit detectors are magnificent. And so they call shit when they see it. So they already, they don't have, put it this way, they don't have year after year of guardedness and protected layers that most of us adults have on, right? So it doesn't take much. So typically what I'll do, and when I work with young people, is simply get to know them as deeply as I can, as quickly as I can. I'll ask them, well, what matters the most to you? What do you really dream of as a manifestation for your life? You know, what are you deeply passionate around? What makes you very angry? Because often that passion and that anger can be right adjacent, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't take long, and typically you can find out. And then from there, it doesn't take long to sort of think, okay, well, I helped put this organization together called Youth Passageways. And it's a clearinghouse of information designed for parents world over to come to figure out, where do I go to get my adolescents initiated and mentored? Where do I go? And it's even broken down by modality. So if you want something wilderness, nature related, great. We've got something for you. If you want a rabbi who is doing bar and bat mitzvah practice, but with real transformational intent, right? Which is a little bit different from how it's been co-opted in the everyday.
I remember.
Yeah.
Co-opted.
Yeah.
I'm still
And Christian and on, right? All these different modalities of initiation and mentorship. So they're all there on the site. And then, so anyway, I know most of these people because I've studied with them and learned from them for years. And I can recommend, well, you know, maybe you want to spend a week in the woods, you know, with a group called the School of Lost Borders, who are doing beautiful work with teens. That's what I do. But it all starts with listening deeply.
Yes, it does, on every level. Hey, you know, I didn't mention this to you. This, everybody out there, this is a bit of a commercial, but there's nothing I can do about it. I have a hat as director of Love Serve Remember Foundation, and we just put out a new book, You Are the Universe, young adult book. And I need to get with you, Frederick, on this book. What it is, Ram Dass Maps the Journey is the subtitle. It just came out. And in it, these two twin sisters, Julie and Amy, who have been long-time students of Ram Dass and knew the material quite well, they transcribed an arc from Ram Dass, from his days in Harvard, all the way through identity and roles, and going to India and meeting the guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and then doing the work that he's done in service and everything else that he has represented over these decades till he died three years ago. And in it, it's sort of put together like Be Here Now. So the first part is these wonderfully edited Ram Dass's story, like my story and Be Here Now. And the second part is brown pages with beautiful, this is all brought to a beautiful presentation with watercolor. See, this is a commercial with beautiful watercolors and so on. One of the girls is an artist. And then, so that's the brown pages in the middle. And then the end, all of the things that Ram Dass recommended for people, as you just listed some of them, in terms of the different practices that you've gotten into over the years. And so he presents that plethora of available means for people to find that different perspective and be able to get on the path. So can I send you a copy, Frederick?
I'd love to read it. Absolutely. Please.
And then what we'd love to do, I want to go even further. I want to send a bunch so that they can go to some kids. And I'd love to see what the possibilities are there for them to connect with someone like Ram Dass. Because, I mean, so many people to this day pick up Be Here Now and write to us and go, oh, my God, we just found out about Ram Dass. And, you know, maybe a little psychedelic thrown in here and there as well. But as part of it, it brings me back to the earliest of days. And I say, geez, the same thing happened to me. So amazing. Anyhow, this is the kind of work that Ram Dass really emphasized towards the end of his life. He would say, make sure next generation gets this information, these teachings. He wouldn't even call it teachings. He would say information available to next gen and on the platforms that they go to, you know. And so we're on TikTok and, you know, got an incredible person who's an interlocutor for Ram Dass on TikTok. It's pretty amazing. So he was full bore into wanting this to happen. And this is just before he left, before he died, and made sure I was aware of that. I mean, of course, I was aware because we used to speak all the time, but made sure that it got executed. And I knew a little bit of your work here, Frederick, but not, I think it's to a much greater extent than I really realized. So, yeah.
Well, and if I may, I'd love to share with your listeners a quote from Ram Dass about my first book.
Yeah.
Which was called At Death Do Us Part. And it's a story about escorting my late wife to her death and my journey through the grief afterwards. She died July 7, 2016. Uh-huh. And the book came out, it was about a year and a half later. And, you know, I felt so blessed to get this beautiful quote from Ram Dass. Most people know Frederick Marx from Hoop Dreams, Journey from Zanskar, and other fine films. They probably don't know that he's a longtime student of Dharma, an ordained Zen priest, and a gifted writer exploring the terrain of the human heart. This book shivers with the frailties of what it means to be human, enfolding loss in all its forms, finding a way through acceptance back to love.
Mm.
And, you know, I must say that for my part, I always used to say my life is very simple. It's about two things. It's about art and service.
Mm.
After my wife died, and after my journey through the grief, I realized I needed to add a third thing. And I said, it's about art, service, and love. And I really have to bow in the direction of Ram Dass in a way, too, for that, because he was always so beautifully open and unafraid and unashamed, you know, to talk about love, you know. And, you know, for me, that hasn't been so easy, but it's getting easier now. Mm. And I recognize the importance for me of outing myself and saying that that's true of me as well.
That's great, Frederick. You know Sharon Salzberg, of course, or who she is.
Of course.
Yeah. So we were doing a retreat with Ram Dass, actually, in Maui. And he was introducing at that time his last really great teaching, which was loving awareness and getting out of this perspective of believing your story, your thoughts, you know, acting like this is all real and everything else. Well, sometimes once in a while you may get a little break from that where you're not judging or pushing or pulling or grasping or, You know, so you move from there and you take a few breaths into the center of your chest and I am loving awareness. And you move that perspective away. This was his great offering in the last years of his life, really. Mm. So we were doing something around that and Sharon was talking about the definition of love. It's very difficult here in the West. It usually denotes, not usually, 99.9, it's a business. I'm going to love you if you love me. Mm. It's not going to happen if that mutuality isn't happening.
It's transactional.
It's transactional. Yeah, exactly. And then Sharon said, and now the problem with love is when you talk about it, people think you're weak. I remember when she said that, I went, that is so horrible. My God. But it's true.
It's so true. Yeah. Well, and I would argue, especially for men, you know, and having spent so much of my life looking at and trying to define and live up to mature masculinity, you know, that might be one of the toughest challenges, you know, to really embrace the importance of being a vulnerable, open heart. And from that place, sharing love with the world and accepting love in.
Yeah. I'm sure you know this, but His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, has often said, our future and for us to transform, he didn't quite say it in these terms, polarity and us and them, basically this is what he was talking about, you know, war, hate, all of it, lies in mothers who are like my mother. His mother apparently was this extraordinarily compassionate human being. And he said that compassion, if our daughters are brought up in that atmosphere, and they can embody that compassion, and then it goes forward from generation to generation. That is our hope, right? And
beautifully said.
Yeah,
it's so true.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you see it in your film, the Journey film. It's really palpable there. You know, I just mentioned. Just seeing those women and what they felt for those children leaving, at the same time feeling, wow, this is a great thing that's happening for my child. The two things at the same time, that kind of, yeah, that's something we need to bring back into this as much as we can into next generation. And so I applaud the work you're doing, Frederick. Absolutely. Well, I think that's all she wrote as far as the sponsor's concerned. It's like the 50s, right?
Yeah, right.
Ajax is right. Proud to present. Yeah. Oh, God.
Bermache. No.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't leave home without it.
Yeah. So happy to have you here. We've been going back and forth, Frederick and I, for a while, and this is great. I'm really happy. And everything we've been talking about will be available to link to in the show notes on, you go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling. And yeah, you will.
Well, and I'll just let your listeners know they can find me too.
Yes.
My website, warriorfilms.org.
Yeah. Do you have a new film coming, by the way?
Well, I just finished a 5-film series on veterans.
Oh, yes. I did see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And if I may, I'll just mention briefly the one of the five. I think they're all full of love. But the one that might most interest your listeners is a story about 22 women veterans who come together for a 4-month meditation mindfulness-based retreat. And they start out in a very alienated, very suspicious place. And we see over time how they begin to bond. And that sense of other begins to disappear. Mm. And they become a pretty bonded sisterhood by the end of it. Mm. So it's the whole series is called Veterans Journey Home. And that particular film is called On Black Mountain. Because it's named after a Tibetan retreat center that is in Sonoma County, not far from San Francisco, called Black Mountain. So you might want to look at that on the website, too.
Yes, everybody. That website will be in the show notes. And, of course, there'll be links for you to be able to get to the film that Frederick's speaking to. Hey, thanks again, Frederick, for being here. And, you know, I've already told you a million times how much I love that movie, Journey from Zanskar. Exceptional.
Well, thank you. Great. I hope you'll get a chance to see some of my other work.
Yeah, no, I'm going to check out this film that you just mentioned. That sounds fascinating, actually. But let's hear more from you in the future. Which I know we will.
I feel like we've got a lot more to talk about. Thank you, Raghu. A real pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, thank you, Frederick. Everybody, we'll see you next week. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and enjoy the plethora of incredible teachers like Jack Kornfield, who I tried to get Frederick to sort of impersonate. I'm going to tell Jack that. That's great. wonderful. We'll see you all next week.